Welcome, everyone. Today we have a great program, an informational meeting on inmate reentry into the community. And we will start with a panel with our honorable director of the Corrections Department, Max Williams, and Claudia Black, who's the associate director for the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute at Portland State University, and Cindy Duran from Chemeketa Community College. Assuming all those folks are here.
All right, you too.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Max Williams, the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm pleased to be joined here with both Cindy and Claudia on this panel today to talk to you about reentry issues in the broad sense, and specifically to give you some remarks today on a particular aspect of reentry that the Department of Corrections is involved in with our Children of Incarcerated Parents project. Just as a matter of brief business, Madam Chair, after my remarks, I'd be pleased to take questions. I'm double booked with the population forecast meeting over at the Department of Administrative Services, so if, with the Chair's permission, at the conclusion of my remarks and any questions the committee has, if I could be excused, I'd appreciate that.
Well, excuse you, and I apologize for starting a little late. I didn't realize your time constraint.
No problem, Madam Chair. Just to give you some preliminary information, the Oregon Department of Corrections houses more than 12,700 inmates statewide, and approximately 95% of these inmates will eventually be released from prison and return to our communities. Statistically, about 30% of our released offenders return to incarceration within 3 years because of new felony conviction. Called recidivism, the consequences of repeat offenders are felt by families and communities in terms of public safety and by the criminal justice system, which bears the cost to investigate, arrest, convict, and incarcerate repeat offenders. To keep our communities safe, reduce pressures on the criminal justice system, and slow the demand for prison beds, the Department of Corrections strives to shape the kind of people offenders will be when they reenter society. While they are in custody, DOC works to identify and address inmates' risks, the risk factors for future criminal behavior, and the goal is to provide inmates with the skills and resources to allow them to choose to lead successful lives upon release. We have a variety of programs and areas that deal with transition, and specifically we have reorganized one division in the entire department to be the Transitional Services Division to focus those areas particularly. Included in that is our Alternative Incarceration Program, our Education and Workforce Development Program, Alcohol and Drug Treatment, Cognitive Programs, Religious Services, our Victim Services, and the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project, which I'm here to talk briefly with you about today. We know that the research is quite clear that transitioning back into the community from prison, a person is more likely to be successful if they have strong relationships with family members, including their children. Nationally, the number of children whose parents are incarcerated has increased dramatically over the past decade, rising from about 1 million in 1991 to the current estimate of almost 2 million nationally. Over 10 million children have had a parent who has been in prison at some point in their lives. To give you a sense of the Oregon statistics in that number, there are more than 20,000 children in Oregon who have a parent currently in prison. And two-thirds of the inmate population in the state have children who are under the ages of 18. 41% of the children in foster care have a parent or caregiver who has been or is a convicted felon. Over half of the parents expect to live with their children upon release, but very few of them actually receive visits within the system. For the children, there is an absolutely statistically identifiable correlation between having an incarcerated parent and the likelihood of future delinquency. Studies show that children of incarcerated parents exhibit multiple risk factors for later delinquency. The risk factors can be mitigated, however, by improved attachment with their parents, better parental discipline, and consistent alternative caregivers. It's very clear that there is a connection, not only from being a child of a parent who's incarcerated into delinquency, but also the clear understanding that we see regularly that parents do not stop being parents simply because they're in prison. There is continuing parenting going on. Whether it's positive parenting or negative parenting is really the question that we end up addressing. But there is very little question that parenting continues even when someone is in prison. The DOC formed the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project work group 5 years ago to develop recommendations for improving outcomes for children of incarcerated parents, and there are over 25 agencies and organizations that are currently involved in that work group. A number of accomplishments that I'd like to share with you, but I would like to comment that many of you were involved in passing the legislation that ultimately led to the department's ability to focus on this area in the last couple of legislative sessions. Significant strides have been made throughout the criminal justice system in implementing policies and practices which will help improve outcomes for these children. A number of them involve not just the incarceration portion, but law enforcement officials throughout Oregon are discussing how to reduce trauma when children are present when their parents are arrested. 25% of inmates have reported to us that their children were present at the time of their arrest. From the judicial side, more than a dozen judges recently have toured the women's facility at Coffee Creek and observed an inmate panel of women who were incarcerated and participating in the program in an effort to better understand the issues facing the children of incarcerated parents. In July of 2004, the Criminal Justice Policy Research Institute at PSU performed a survey to assess standard jail policies and procedures relating to visiting practices for children whose parents are in jail. And a number of jail managers are working to provide a less stressful environment for those visits by children. From the DOC perspective, probably the issue that's gotten the most attention is our Parenting Inside Out education program, which inmates are offered. It's a 12-week training course with 36 sessions that provide opportunities for growth in parenting knowledge and skill, and the topics range from child development to discipline to the transition home. The curriculum is an evidence-based product that it was developed jointly with the Oregon Social Learning Center and designed specifically to meet the unique needs of parenting effectively from prison. The curriculum actually was so innovative that we were certainly proud, and I think the Oregon Social Learning Center has a right to be proud, that the National Institute of Mental Health gave a $3.2 million grant to the Oregon Social Learning Center for a study of its long-term effectiveness of this program. It began in 2003 and will continue through 2008. It involves 400 inmates, 200 caregivers, and their children in that study. And obviously we're all anxious to see the impact and the results from the program that we feel very strongly has successful opportunities. Other highlights from our in-prison programs include a federally funded Head Start program that serves children ages 3 and under whose mothers are incarcerated at Coffee Creek. We have a Girl Scouts Beyond Bars program expanding in Coffee Creek with an increasing enrollment to more than 130 girls. There's a new Boy Scout program on the grounds at Coffee Creek, again involving parents in that program. An Even Start family literacy program is offered through a partnership with PCC that serves mothers and their children. And we have changed our visiting rules to allow more opportunities for inmates and parents to visit with their children. We have worked with other organizations where we do presentations for those families who have a member of their family incarcerated to address the issues involved in an orientation process so they understand the complications sometimes that this brings and how to access the various services within the system. DOC has provided more than 8,000 copies of How to Explain Jails and Prisons to Children and a Caregiver's Guide, which is designed to help those who are taking care of these children while this parent is incarcerated with the tools that they would need to helping the child understand what the situation is and those issues involved in the relationship. There are other opportunities in work of our partners. A great example is the Wilsonville Rotary Club, which sponsors a Through a Child's Eyes program that occurs at the Coffee Creek facility every year. And it demonstrates, I think, perhaps most effectively, that in all of these things you've heard me discuss, it's all partners. We have partners at every single level. There's a strong realization, and I think you'll hear that throughout the presentation today, that the way we get in front of the issues involving reentry and transition is through partners. The Department of Corrections can't do it by themselves, but neither can any of these other groups. Together, we have to work in a coordinated fashion to address this issue. The Oregon Youth Authority, in a survey of its close custody youth, found that 19% of the youth that they were holding in close custody were already the parents of one or more children. Many of the young offenders from OIA have also been the child of parents who have served and been incarcerated in the system. OIA is now piloting the Parent Inside Out parent education curriculum for young mothers at their Hillcrest facility. A number of various other programs that we're proud to have been associated with in working with the efforts that individual county community corrections agencies are moving forward. Both Washington and Multnomah County have established multidisciplinary teams that visit women in prison several months prior to release and collaboratively create release plans through a case management model. Multnomah County Community Justice has created a family services unit to work closely with offenders who have children under the age of 18. Again, it's all about this partnership and relationship that we have through community corrections and the other service providers. I think what I would like to say now is also just comment on another aspect of a partnership, and that's the Children's Justice Alliance, which is a 501c3 organization based at Portland State University, and it was really brought online to further the efforts of the Children of Incarcerated Parents program. I recently had the opportunity to go to an opening of a Center for Family Success in the St. John's area, where they have targeted a community that has a particular high-level need, opened a community center with the help of the community, which will serve children of incarcerated parents and their families and those releasing back to the community by providing programs, social support, and activities. Again, it's an example of a specific community that had a need and an ability of bringing numerous collaborators together to try to address that need. We continue to hope that this team-building effort among professionals across all disciplines will assure that we are able to make some headway on our issues with reentry. I described in my comments that evening at the Center for Family Success opening in St. John's that it was really, in my mind, sort of a beachhead, you know, the first opportunity where we've had to put that kind of a center on the ground in a specific community, and one that I hope we can continue to see follow as other communities step up to the plate and work in cooperation with the Department of Human Services, DOC, and other agencies to provide that kind of support. With that, Madam Chair, I know that there are other people here this afternoon to chat with you about transition-related issues. I would tell you that under the legislation that was passed regarding the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project, that they are required to present a report to the legislature. The 2001 and 2003 legislatures received that report. I know that that report will be forthcoming shortly for the 2005 legislature and will be distributed to you. And they will have a list of recommendations on what the legislature can do to further enhance this issue, particularly the issue of children of incarcerated parents, but the impact that it has on transition back to community. So with that, Madam Chair, I would be happy to take any questions, at which point, after the questions, I'll take just a moment to introduce the next person that's going to speak to you on this panel today, and then I'll excuse myself from the committee.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Starr.
Yes, we've talked previously about the effectiveness of the faith community in working with prisoners, both within and through the transition period. Is there active outreach to the faith community in that regard, and particularly as regards alcohol and drug services?
Madam Chair and Senator Starr, there is active outreach, and I think I've briefly perhaps touched on it before in my conversation with the committee. The Department of Corrections has a program that it's currently operating and working on expanding called the Going Home for Good in Oregon program, where we use community chaplaincy, essentially, volunteer chaplains in the community to help us transition those individuals who have been involved successfully in a faith-related program in the department. They've attended a particular religious service or become actively involved, and if they want that support for ongoing mentoring upon release, what we have tried to do in each county is to develop a community chaplaincy where we can tie those people back to a community they'll be returning to and have a faith community available to them who would be willing and ready to accept them as they come back and provide some of those mentoring services. There's training involved. We have one of our department chaplains overseas working with the community, volunteers, and we're very excited about the impact that we think that this program will continue to have. As that goes on and as it develops, it is about more than just simply providing a faith-based community, but having that community also help us target and make available resources from ideas about potential employment for this individual to getting them and assisting and supporting them through treatment, alcohol and drug treatment that might continue perhaps on the outside, to issues of housing, for example, which are always a challenge. So it's a combination of efforts that we hope that they'll continue to sort of provide assistance to as these individuals come back to community, and we believe it's proven to be very effective. Over 50% of the inmates within the system regularly participate in some amount of religious services while they're in the system, and we think it's an important, again, like having strong family connection when a person releases, and having that strong family connection be one of the things that helps that person transition successfully back into a situation where they're less likely to reoffend. Those other kinds of community supports, and part of that is having people who are willing to accept someone with a felony on their record, look beyond that and attempt to provide support and assistance to that individual as they get back on their feet, is part of that message.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Are there questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity. It is now really very much my pleasure to introduce to you Cindy Duren. Cindy spent 3 years in prison, and I've actually been with Cindy on several occasions where she's presented and spoke to various panels and groups. She has beaten one of those people. If you want to talk a little bit about methamphetamine, I think Cindy can answer some of your questions about it. She's successfully beaten a 13-year addiction to methamphetamine. During her time in prison, she took advantage of a number of opportunities to improve her life and the lives of her 5 children, of whom she has custody. She'll graduate from Chemeketa next term, where she is currently on the dean's list. And I think you'll be very interested to hear her remarks today and how, one example of someone who has successfully taken advantage of the programs and has turned their lives around on transition, a real model case and one that we're proud to showcase with you here today. So with that, committee members, I'll give you Ms. Duren.
Thank you. Before we get into your presentation, just in case there's anybody here in the audience for Senate Bill 208, we will be putting that over for another meeting, so don't worry about that coming up. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Duren, and I am a recovering meth addict. I used meth for 13 years, and in 2 weeks I'll have 4 years clean. So I've been asked to talk today a little bit about my story, what got me here, and where I hope to go from here. I grew up in Mount Angel, Oregon, and went to high school there, graduated. When I was a junior, I got pregnant and had a son. I still had 1 year of school, so I was able to continue and graduate. Immediately upon my graduation, I got a job with the Department of Insurance and Finance at Workers' Compensation. I worked there for, I think it was about 3 years, and during that time, I was introduced to methamphetamine. I'm really nervous.
Oh, don't be nervous. We look more intimidating than we really are.
So I started using meth recreationally. That lasted about a week. So then after that, I would say within 2 weeks I was clearly addicted and started using daily. I don't think I remember a day from during those 13 years except maybe during my pregnancy, that I did not use methamphetamine. Probably for the first couple of years, I think, of using meth, I was still, what I felt, still able to have control over my use, still able to work if I wanted to work, do things that I needed to do. After that, it became using meth to go to sleep, to wake up, to function, to drive, to get through the day. There was no other way. If I didn't have meth in the morning, then I just wasn't getting out of bed that day. If my children got out of bed that day, that was fine. If they didn't, that was fine. If they were outside, it didn't matter to me as long as my day was spent looking for meth.
And how many children did you have at this point?
At that time, I had three.
Three children.
Three children. My oldest, Tyler, he, at 9 years old, decided that life at home was too chaotic for him. He was just out on the streets doing what he had to do to get to school, to get home from school, and take care of himself. He decided to go to move out and live with his dad, which, luckily for me, his dad was a very good parent and was willing to take him in. So I think that was a really good decision that he made on his own. Probably about in 1998 was when I had two kids in 1997. Actually, I had one in December and one in January of 1997. And I think probably the year after that was when I started with identity theft, committing crimes to support my habit. Before that, I had been able to work and get my meth anyway, you know, through paying for it. After that, I was no longer what you'd call functioning, and so I started committing crimes to support my habit. Me and my kids' father split up at that time because he wasn't willing to involve himself in the things that I was doing, and somebody needed to take care of the kids. To me, being a parent was, I never felt that I wasn't a good parent, even though I was using meth. I looked at it like I was a good parent because I would keep my kids with me while I was doing meth, or I would take them with me to go buy it. And I felt that the people who were the bad parents were the ones who dropped off their kids somewhere else. And as long as I kept my kids with me all day, then I was an awesome parent. You know, I was still holding things together. I started committing crimes, going in and out of jail. Didn't do any kind of programmings in jail. I would just go in and think about getting out and getting high again. I think the longest time that I was in there was 42 days. And on that day when I knew I was going to be released, I mean, all the talk that I had done about wanting to see my kids hadn't come to visit me, making, you know, bargains with God that if he just let me out, I wouldn't go back to meth, all of that. I called my kids that day, let them know I was coming out, called my grandma, and she was going to have the kids together. It was all set up for me. From the time that I was released, I made it up the street to the gas station, and I was high again probably within half an hour. I got high in the bathroom. It took me 3 days to get home, to what I called home, to get back to my kids. As much as my intentions were to go home, I still hadn't beaten that addiction. I didn't have the tools that I needed to say no or to do something different. Eventually, my last arrest, I had my son with me. He was, I think, three at the time. We were arrested in a motel room. And when I was arrested, I actually chose to grab the drugs that I left on the bed instead of my child and tried to run. And I left him sitting on the bed. So I was arrested, charged with child neglect, child endangerment, possession of controlled substance, all different charges, identity theft. Eventually, I was indicted, I think, on 42 felonies. That, I guess, is where I had hit rock bottom at that time. I was pregnant again when I went to prison. I was sentenced to 34 months. I went to prison in July and had my son in September. He was taken into foster care the next day, and I didn't see him again for 15 months. I was told by DHS that I would have 12 months after that time that they would start the adoption process to place him somewhere else. He was in a really in the good foster care. And probably the first year of my incarceration, I didn't really do anything. I was just in there waiting it out, and if I got high again, that was okay with me. I knew the consequences at this point, but I didn't really know anything about addiction recovery, what I was going to do afterwards, how to be a good parent. What changed that for me was the parenting program that they had at Coffee Creek. I even went to boot camp. They sent me to boot camp, and I felt bad, and I came back from boot camp. So I started taking a parenting class, and there were just things in there that I would never even thought of, how to play with my kids, if things were age-appropriate for them, just how to be nurturing, know that my kids were all individuals and each one needed to be treated differently instead of just clumping them together no matter what age they were, their personality. After I completed phase one of parenting, which was 12 weeks, I went into phase two. Eventually, I think I did like 80 or 90 hours of parenting classes. During that same time, there was a program there, Early Head Start, that I hadn't heard of, and I didn't know if they had heard of me, but they came over probably about a week before my parental rights were going to be terminated with my son, Jacob, the one that had been born in prison. And they came over and told me that he was, that I had a hearing, and did I want them to advocate for me, which they did. A couple weeks later, I was granted visitation with him, and so he was put into the Early Head Start program also, and that was the first place that I saw him 15 months later. We started developing that bond, and I continued with my programs. I went into drug treatment, Turning Point, and that's where I started getting the education that I needed how to go be in recovery, and I truly started to understand the issues that I had. Everything with trust issues, abandonment, all those issues that I feel lead to somebody using that. Not you don't just go out and say, I want to become an addict. There's something underneath that. So during Turning Point, I think the last 3 months, I started working on my transition plan, the one I was going to be released. I had numerous people helping me work on this, and I was given a mentor. I was going to pull to Marion County, and 2 days before I was going to pull, the budget was frozen for any housing subsidy. So I came out on June 20th with absolutely nowhere to pull to. I gave the address for my sister's house, and I went to my PO, my parole officer, and I was told that I wouldn't be assigned as a parole officer for another month, but it was like a temporary parole officer. So I told them, I needed a little bit more structure than that. And so, I told them I'll come back on Monday, Tuesday, even though they had sent me an appointment for a month away. I just didn't feel right coming out after 3 years and not having any kind of supervision for 30 days. I was used to the structure, and so that's what I did. I went to an Oxford house with absolutely no money. The only thing I came out of prison with was like $20 that I had in my trust fund and the sweats that they gave me and a backpack. I was able to convince the other women at the Oxford house that I would be willing to do whatever it took to stay clean and sober, that I would be willing to get a job, and I didn't have any kind of transportation. I had to learn the bus system. I had never ever been on a bus before, and that's what I did. They accepted me in there, and I started doing exactly what I told them I was going to be doing, going to NA meetings. I started getting visits with my kids. Eventually, those turned into overnight visits, and eventually in July, I was granted full custody of my kids. We got it up. I stayed at Oxford House for 5 months, and was able to get an apartment on my own. My kids live with me. This past August, my oldest son, the one that he moved away when he was 10, he's 17 now, but he came back to live with me, you know, on his own without me asking him to come. He just made that choice after seeing the changes that I had made. And being, I had already been clean in, out here on the outside for a year. So that's been really interesting. I go to Chenectadi. I'll graduate in June with an associate's degree in business administration. I'm on the dean's list. I think this is my second or third term on the dean's list. And I just have one more class that I need to take next spring. I got a full scholarship for spring term. And I'm doing my internship at Arches with part of Community Action Agency, and we help provide housing for homeless people or people who are at risk of becoming homeless. I'm a peer mentor also at Arches, and I'm not sure what else to say, but I think that's it.
So. That was very compelling. Thank you for sharing that with us.
If there's any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
That means a lot to all of us that you're willing to share your story with us. I did have one question. One is, we struggle with the methamphetamine issue. One of the things that keeps emerging is how horribly addictive it is and how hard it is to find treatment that works and that people can really stick with. What would you say would be, and you're obviously, I mean, I know it's a day-by-day effort, but you have come a long way, and what... to what would you attribute the success? I mean, was it something about the program or where you were or a combination?
I think it was where I was in the program itself. I don't feel that. Claudia was asking me before, you know, if I thought that was a little bit too much time. And I, you know, like I told her, you haven't seen my record. I had a really long record, and I needed to be somewhere that was very structured, away from society, away from anybody that I knew, any old friends. And maybe not everybody needs inpatient treatment, but I wouldn't have been able to do it with anything but inpatient, where there was nothing else coming into my mind, any other outside influences. I need it to be that structured, but along with the other programs, the parenting programs, and just having a balance between my kids and my treatment that I needed to do.
And you've been clean for 3 years?
It'll be 4 years on the 8th, March 8th.
4 years on March 8th. Well, congratulations. How long was it before you felt that you were able to experience the regular, you know, emotions without that crutch?
While I was in prison, probably about a year and a half before I got any kind of emotion back. Mm-hmm. I didn't, before then, I mean, like I said, for like 15 to 18 months, the only thing that I was able to do was just block out any thoughts of anything going on in my life with my kids. And that was easy for me to do because I was still, I think I still had those chemicals in me and things like that. So that was the easy part, was blocking it out. After, the hard part is when you start getting those feelings back. Mm-hmm. And, I think, well, even last week, I actually went back into the prison, and that was really hard to do. So just learning to, I mean, getting those guilty feelings again, mm-hmm. and just working through that and not going out and using again. So I would say, I think it takes about a year and a half to 2 years before you start getting any kind of regular feelings, emotions back.
Mm-hmm. Well, good for you. Do you go to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting still?
NA meetings. Yeah, I try and go at least twice a week. I should probably go more, but I'm working. I have 5 kids. And make excuses not to go. But
what are the ages of your children?
The oldest is 17, and then I have 8 years old, 7, 4, and 3.
Wow. Well,
so they're all doing really well.
Yeah, you must be very proud of yourself, justifiably.
Thank you.
Are there other questions, Senator Brzezinski?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Duran, thank you again for coming forward and sharing your story. One of the things that it seems that we are always faced with is what can we do to help individuals, especially when they're coming out of an incarcerated structure? And I guess what I'm going to ask you is the philosophy that we have used and what we've seen is that it's the networking of getting the person back to their community where they may have some family ties or other support. But also I'm hearing the same concerns at the same time that when you maybe place someone back in that structure that they can, in fact, relapse back to their, let's say, their friends who really may not be their friends and you can find the old crutches. Could you give us your thoughts as to, one, should we look at maybe placement of individuals outside of maybe where they started or some combination? Should they go into some type of structured program that might be a halfway house or some type of program that's not maybe in the community they would be permanently residing in, then shifting or something like that? Or what are your thoughts of how we might be able to better equip individuals such as yourself with the ability to overcome and not have those temptations?
For myself, I don't think that it's going to change if someone is paroled to a different county than where they came from, because whether or not a meth addict is going to find meth, whether it be in Marion County, Multnomah County, Clackamas County, I don't care whether I knew the person or not. If you look like you might have some dope for me, I was going to go talk to you. So whether you were a friend of mine or not, I would have gotten it where I needed to get it if I didn't have the tools already that I needed to stay clean. As far as transition, for someone coming out of prison, I think there should be housing funded, transitional housing. I would not have felt safe if I was coming out to my own apartment or even to my family's, which I was supposed to come to my family's, but that wasn't a safe place for me either. So I feel the most support that anybody could get would be in a transitional house with other people who are in recovery, where you had that support. Even though I didn't know these other seven women who were in this house, they were all willing to go to NA meetings because I had never been to one. And that's just where my support came from them, my mentor. So I think that the mentor program is very important. And just having other resources. My mentor provided me with a lot of resources, things that I didn't know were available that I didn't think anybody would be willing to help me. And what has made me successful is the fact that I was able to, not have prison be a setback to me and not be embarrassed of where I had been and just be honest and straightforward. This is where I'm coming from and this is what I need and how can you help me if I'm not taking it just as a handout and I'm willing to give back also to my community.
Okay, thank you. One other question? We're going to hear from another presentation from Sponsors, which is a program out of Eugene, which I'm pretty familiar with from my representation of those group before. But I guess I'm going to ask you, maybe it might be a little more difficult question since Claudia is sitting next to you. What is it that we should be looking at for people who are actually in custody? What I'm hearing and what we see a lot of times, and especially in budget shortfalls, we're looking at how do we make ends meet. And it seems like programs that might actually give individuals such as yourself a better chance of recovery and not relapsing back into the system. What is it that we need to be considering as to what would be important for helping that first step for those who want that assistance while they're in custody?
Are you talking about in custody in county jails or state custody?
Cause both.
In county jails, I definitely feel that there needs to be some kind of program available. I think there's NA available in Marion County. It wasn't really pushed that much, but I think there needs to be some kind of parenting programs in jail, some kind of treatment, because I know that, I'm not sure, but I was never offered those programs or made aware of those programs, and it might have changed the way I was thinking before I ended up going to prison. And at the state level, the programs that are offered at Coffee Creek are, I mean, invaluable. If I didn't have those programs, I would never have been successful. So I think the parenting is probably the most important program, along with any cognitive programs, changing the way I think, because my thought process was so screwed up. I mean, it was like watching a movie in my head, you know, thinking that I didn't have a thought process, not knowing how to slow that. And I learned in, I think it was Pathfinders, one of the cognitive programs is just doing something, thinking about what the thought was that went through my head. And then I'm able to do that out here. So I think those programs are very important.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very, very much for coming. You did a great job. Okay, now we've heard about sponsors, and we have a representative of sponsors here, Paul Solomon. Mistake of having lunch with me the other day. I was so excited about his program that I invited him right up here for this presentation. So glad you could make it, Paul.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today about a subject that I'm very passionate about. My name is Paul Solomon. I'm the Director of Men's Services at Sponsors Incorporated in Eugene, and I'm here today to offer my perspective and insight regarding prisoner reentry. My experience in the field is quite diverse. As a child, I witnessed my grandfather, Federal Judge Gus Solomon, sentence many a person to prison. Ironically and painfully, many years later, as a young adult, I was sentenced in the Gus J. Solomon Courthouse in downtown Portland. Without the benefit of transitional housing and reentry services, I can say with certainty I would not be here today. Having navigated a path out of federal and state prison, I am well acquainted with reentry issues. For the past 30 years, Sponsors has been dedicated to assisting Lane County's ex-offender population in their reentry to the community. We play an integral role in the transition of ex-offenders from prison back to the community. Providing for our clients' most basic needs is among our top priorities. Sponsors provides housing, food, clothing, and a safe, clean, and sober environment. The agency also assists clients in accessing health care, medications, counseling, job and treatment referrals, as well as help finding stable housing upon completion of our program. Sponsors operates three men's programs and one women's program, providing a total of 75 beds. Included are beds dedicated to clients with chronic mental illness, physical disabilities, women with children, and clients serving 1145 sanctions being monitored electronically. In addition, we have a grant-funded program for students devoted to ex-offenders entering college and one housing facility solely for sex offenders. The agency also plays a critical public safety role. When high-risk offenders are released, more often than not, parole and probation asks us to take them in. Some pose great risks to reoffend: serial sex offenders, predatory pedophiles, and others. By placing them at Sponsors, we offer a measure of security and accountability. In addition to providing case management, we monitor clients' whereabouts, perform regular drug screens, and make sure they are in compliance with the conditions of their release. With this careful monitoring, we are able to identify cyclical behaviors that lead to reoffending and often nip them in the bud. Numerous studies have reflected that high-risk offenders benefit most from the structured transitional housing, most notably those conducted by Dr. Ed Latessa at the University of Cincinnati. Equally challenging is the population of ex-offenders who have serious physical and/or mental health issues. More and more, we are serving clients just released from prison with disabilities which severely taxes agency resources. Since the cuts to the Oregon Health Plan, which took effect last July, The vast majority of our clients have been rendered ineligible. The Department of Corrections is supposed to provide a 30-day supply of medications to inmates at the time of their release. However, we frequently find that ex-offenders wind up without them. When these individuals arrive at sponsors, one of our first duties is to ensure that clients have an adequate supply of medication. In the event that they do not, we are often left with a trip to the emergency room as the only immediate alternative. Through use of community correction monies, we provide funding for bus passes and identification. Without a means of transportation and identification, accessing services and acquiring employment can be difficult, if not impossible. Imagine trying to get a job, such as working in the fast food industry without ID. It won't happen. In order for transitional services to be effective, you need a broad range of resources. At Sponsors, we work hard to cultivate relationships with property managers and with the business community to provide to provide regular housing and employment opportunities for our men and women, ensuring employers that through drug screens we can offer drug-free employees who make it to work on time. We network with doctors, medical clinics, treatment providers, and the courts to assist our clients in the reentry process. We also enjoy a strong, mutually beneficial relationship with parole and probation. Two of our men's facilities have offices for parole officers who are outstationed there. Many of our clients, by virtue of their age or disability, are eventually approved for Social Security. However, it is a lengthy and cumbersome process. With high rates of attrition, exacerbated by the Department of Corrections' extremely slow process of providing medical records. For clients with chronic illness, the inability to access health care and prescription medications can compromise quality of life, affect their ability to function productively, and result in unnecessary and avoidable decline, requiring costly medical care or hospitalization. In some cases, inability to acquire mental health medications can lead to decompensation and ultimately reincarceration. Last year, Sponsors provided residential services for 275 clients in Lane County. Historically, our clients have enjoyed high levels of success, between 60 and 70% every year for the past 10 years. We define success as being employed or in school full-time, clean drug and alcohol screens, acquisition of stable housing upon completion of our program, and compliance with conditions of parole. Under the guidance of Ron Chase, our executive director, Sponsors has grown in recent years in an attempt to meet the ever-increasing demand for transitional services. 60% of our funding is community corrections dollars. In our most recent financial audit, it was determined that 94% of Sponsors' $800,000 budget went to direct service, with 6% for administration. We maintain a 3 to 4 month waiting list. In the past, we were able to serve people being released from the county jail. However, budget cuts and the increasing population of parolees have forced us to shift our priorities to those coming out of state custody, most of whom have served 3 years or more. The majority of our clients have nowhere else to go, and without our services would most likely wind up on the streets or back in the environment that led to their offense at much greater risk to reoffend. It is time for a shift in policy that alleviates the growth in corrections. We need policy that promotes public safety while offering opportunities for ex-offenders. More than half the state's prison population are non-Measure 11 offenders. It is time to consider increasing earned good time for prisoners. Earned good time makes sense. As a former prisoner, I can tell you what it means to shave just one day off of one sentence. It gives prisoners a vested interest in change. It gives people the incentive to engage in treatment. And it saves the state precious dollars for other much-needed services. Another approach would be to expand the alternative incarceration programs that are currently being operated at Shutter Creek, Coffee Creek, and Powder River Correctional Institutions. These programs offer sentence reductions of up to 30 months, thereby reducing future incarceration costs of roughly $24,000 annually per person. Unfortunately, these programs account for a mere 412 beds out of a system that now incarcerates nearly 13,000 people. These programs equate to future victims, or these programs equate to fewer future victims and collateral costs of future incarceration. As an agency, we have accepted large numbers of program graduates. In fact, we have served nearly every boot camp graduate released to Lane County since Shutter Creek opened. As a whole, they are better prepared, have a greater stake in their future, and transition back into the community with greater success than those who do not have the benefit of such programming. Similarly, we need to heed research that reflects lower recidivism rates for those who complete cognitive-based restructuring programs, alcohol and drug treatment, and education while in prison. The governor is asking for cuts to these evidence-based programs within the institutions. By the state's own estimate, over 75% of the prison population has moderate to severe substance abuse issues. We cannot continue to strip the institutions of programming, as well as funding for treatment in the community, and expect not to foster future incarceration, ruin lives, and additional victims. The efficacy of treatment over incarceration is nothing new. However, cash-strapped states across the country are just beginning to implement alternatives to incarceration, modifying parole, and closing prisons. A recent policy brief by the Justice Policy Institute yielded some very interesting results. Citing research by the RAND Corporation and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and other leading criminal justice research agencies, they found that drug treatment, in concert with other services and programs, is a more cost-effective way to deal with drug offenders. A cost-benefit analysis in the state of Washington showed that for every dollar spent on treatment in prison provided a yield of between $1.91 and $2.69. In contrast, therapeutic community programs outside of prison, typically work release facilities, yielded $8.87 of benefit for every dollar spent. In Brooklyn, New York, the Drug Treatment Alternative to Prison program places defendants who have pled guilty who plead guilty to an offense in residential therapeutic treatment system as an alternative to prison for up to 2 years. A recent evaluation of this program by Columbia University found that the program achieved significant results in reducing recidivism and drug use, increased the likelihood of finding employment, and saved money over the cost of incarceration. The evaluation further concluded that the cost of placing a participant in the program, including the cost of residential treatment, vocational training, and support training, was approximately $33,000, half the average cost of imprisonment over the same 25-month period. Eventually, nearly every person in state custody will be released. It is in the public's best interest that these individuals be prepared to transition back into the community successfully. Prison programs in Oregon, including religious services, education, cognitive restructuring, and treatment, make up less than 2.2% of the DOC budget. The governor's budget seeks to reduce programming, prison programming. Prisons void of programming are warehouses. If we can increase DOC's budget by 33%, we can certainly improve upon the existing prison programs. Weighed against the cost of recidivism, it should be a simple equation. If for no other reason than fiscal responsibility, it makes sense to provide treatment for offenders. Ultimately, successful reentry begins in prison. It should include sex offender treatment, which is non-existent in Oregon, residential drug treatment, education, vocational training, job preparation, and anger management, all of which should be linked to services outside of prison. Interagency relationships are critical to create a conceptual link between the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections. We are slated to build 4 new prisons. The governor asks us to accept a 33% increase to the Department of Corrections, while nearly every other agency of government is expected to absorb cuts of 5% or more. It is important to note, however, the state projects the need to build more prisons based on future incarceration trends. It is important to note, however, that much of the burgeoning prison population is due to an increase in time served rather than new admissions. Here again, I believe that by reducing guideline sentences, the state can maintain truth in sentencing and provide sentences that fit the crime while saving money. Similarly, parole and probation is experiencing ever-increasing caseloads as the result of growth in prison parolees, yet they are expected to do more with less. The governor's budget forecasts a 24% increase in parole and post-prison supervision over the next 10 years. Conversely, community corrections faces a 5% budgetary cut in the next biennium. I spoke with a Lane County parole officer last week who has seen his caseload grow from 80 to 117 in the past 2 years. These numbers are not anomalous. As caseloads grow, so should community corrections funding. Without the existing level of supervision, treatment, transitional housing, and corollary programs, we are risking future victims and future incarceration expense to shave the community corrections budget in this biennium. Plain and simple, this is not fiscally sound policy. We are spending over $100 million each budget cycle in debt payments for past prison construction. We have doubled our prison population in just 10 years. Without decisive changes and restructuring to sentencing, corrections, and reentry policy, we will continue to perpetuate a system that chooses incarceration over education, services to seniors, the disabled, services to crime survivors, impoverished families, and health insurance for the working poor. It costs $65 a day to house an inmate in state custody and $105 a day in the Lane County Jail. It costs sponsors $24 a day. Consider the fact that our clients who enter the workforce pay taxes, stimulate the economy, pay child support, treatment fees, parole fees, restitution, and other court-ordered fines. At sponsors, we turn liabilities into assets. It's time for the state to start investing in assets and not liabilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Pazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, thank you for your testimony. When I ran my first time in 94, Ron Chase and I sat down and we talked about the success of sponsors even back then. It's now been a little over 10 years. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if when you get back to the office, when you have a chance to sit down with Ron, there was a program that I've alluded to in this committee once before, and I've done it every session, but I'd like to get more information. I don't have that material anymore.
Okay.
There was a program that was in effect at sponsors, I believe, in the early 90s, mm-hmm. where they monitored, it was a pilot program with DLC, and they had somewhere in the range of 30 inmates who had been released from custody, and they monitored them under strict program for 1 year, mm-hmm. and after 1 year, all but one or two were in complete compliance with their parole. And I know that that is probably the springboard of getting us to what sponsors is today. And I guess what I'd like to find out is what the name of the program was, when it did occur, was that some type of special funding that was made available through a federal grant or a state mm-hmm. grant or whatever, and see what we have learned from that experience where we're at today. And what can we do throughout the state to be able to maybe deal with these issues so we're not going to have those individuals putting themselves back into a system of incarceration and, as you're saying, reoffending and causing more victims mm-hmm. and being more of a liability than an asset once they've come out of the system.
Madam Chair, Senator Pozanski, I'm not familiar with the program that you're talking about. It occurred prior to my working with
right.
sponsors. What I can say is that we do have a program now that houses, it's our honors program, that houses clients for up to 1 year. Generally speaking, these are people who are at the highest risk to reoffend, have the most difficult time transitioning back into the community. Generally speaking, a lot of our clients are high-risk sex offenders that are in the honors program, or people who've served long terms of imprisonment, 10, 15, 20 years, that need more support and structure to be successful over the long haul.
Yeah, let's follow up on that.
That's good.
I don't know if you have any data on that type of on the honors. I think that'd be something that would be also beneficial, because we are always faced with that dilemma. Do we pay more into the system that's going to build more prisons, mm-hmm. or are we going to somehow try to mitigate, as you've given us various examples, and maybe these type of programs where we can show that scientific base of success, mm-hmm. that we'll be able to actually have that dialogue and know that those type of investments are really worthy of being considered.
Madam Chair, Senator Kozanski, my personal opinion, just based on experience, is right now we are faced with so many people being released from prison that our priorities have shifted. You know, there's a great need for people who need long-term structured transitional housing. However, given the number of people who are being released on a daily basis, you know, we have a 3 to 4 month waiting list. We turn people away every day. So we try and move people in and move them out in relatively short order. Most of our clients stay 60 to 90 days. During that time, you know, we hope that they have found employment, saved enough money, and helped them find stable housing on top of all the other obligations that they may have with the courts or treatment. So I agree I would support the need for more long-term housing. The problem is funding and the number of people who are being released.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much, Paul. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Now we will hear from Judy Shipwreck, the Public Safety Coordinating Council of Multnomah County, and Steve Lyday from Multnomah County. I may have mispronounced your name.
That's very close.
Oh, okay, good.
I think that's as good as I can do.
Okay, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Judy Bauman Shipwreck, and for those who have a long institutional memory, I was a member of the House Judiciary Committee for the 87, 89, and 91 sessions. So I kind of sympathize. I know what it's like to be in your seat in the afternoon, you know, hopefully not a really big lunch, because it, you know, makes it kind of a long time. And my testimony is going to be very short. I am currently the director of Multnomah County's Public Safety Coordinating Council, and I know that you on the committee get it. I can see that. Listening to the testimony that came before and to your questions, I can tell that you get it. And I want to confess that while the best time to plant a tree is 18 years ago, maybe in the 87 session when I was here and had an opportunity to do that, the next best time to plant a tree is today. The Public Safety Council is committed to evidence-based practice. I think it's clear that the calculus of public safety is showing that ensuring successful reentry means safer communities and improved use of tax dollars. So it's all positive calculus. Fewer victims, save money. In Multnomah County, reentry and transition services are provided by the Department of Community Justice, and I get to introduce to you Steve Lyday, who is an assistant director with that department.
Thank you.
The committee, Mr. Lyday.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me today to testify about this really important issue of reentry and how that absolutely connects to the successful supervision of offenders in the community.
Okay.
You heard some of the numbers of the prison system today, which incarcerates approximately 12,000 individuals. There will be thousands of inmates being released over the next biennium. Together, the criminal justice system will have invested considerable time and dollars to enhance public safety through arrest, prosecution, indigent defense, conviction, sentencing, and finally incarceration. For a number of these offenders who are sentenced to prison, their sentence will have come amid much attention and publicity. Public safety is important to our citizens, and every day much of our news is devoted to the crime that's occurring, the victims that are left behind, and those individuals responsible. There's a reason that the media pays so much attention to crime, and that's because people want to know that the government is keeping them safe. What will not receive nearly as much attention is when those same offenders are released from prison. The challenges facing prison inmates are really not difficult to understand, particularly if any of us would imagine being removed from our families, our jobs, our support structure, and being gone for an average of 2.5 years. Life continues on without offenders in the home. Meanwhile, those same inmates have spent years and months associating with other convicted felons 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. Research and experience have shown us that the first several months back in the community are the time when the offender is most at risk to abscond from supervision or continue criminal conduct. Why? This is the time when an offender lacks stable housing, employment, access to health care, mental health services, and other supports. This is also a time when acquaintances are being renewed, often with antisocial peers, including those who have been abusing alcohol and drugs and committing crime. Evidence tells us that in order to reduce recidivism, we need to address criminogenic needs such as stable housing, employment, substance abuse, criminal associates, and criminal thinking. These are actually the practices that are required by Senate Bill 267, which was passed last session, which requires an increasing amount of state funds over the next several bienniums to be spent on evidence-based practices. A focus on reentry fits perfectly into that legislation. Obviously, these are no small tasks. Significant barriers face offenders upon their reentry: lack of accessible and affording housing, the high cost of housing in many counties, certainly including Multnomah, which means offenders, not all offenders can afford housing. Access to mental health and substance abuse treatment is also being made more difficult by restrictions for eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. Difficulty finding and maintaining gainful employment with employers who are often reluctant to hire a convicted felon. Fortunately, there are many efforts that are already occurring within existing resources. Every day, correctional staff are involved in tasks that range from helping an offender to get a driver's license, which is no small effort when you don't have proof of residence or birth documents, assessing job skills and participation in education programs needed to gain basic literacy skills. Often, offenders cannot even complete job applications. Also, placement of offenders into substance abuse and mental health treatment programs where we monitor compliance and respond swiftly to problems. On a more formal basis, there are also a number of programs which have been developed. In Multnomah County, we have the Joint Access to Benefits, and Lee Jensen, one of our program managers who was responsible for pulling that program, is here today accompanying me. What that does is that begins the process for applying for SSI, SSD, and Medicaid up to 4 months prior to release from prison. This enables offenders to receive benefits within 30 to 60 days after their release. This is critically important for an offender who is trying to secure stable housing and health care. The Going Home program mentioned earlier by Director Williams involves the State Department of Corrections, Marion and Multnomah Counties, and the Oregon Youth Authority. This is a program which works with high-risk inmates prior to and immediately upon their release. Funded by a federal grant, parole officers go into the institutions and begin meeting with offenders. Those inmates are then involved in weekly transition groups. They meet with employment specialists in prison, and then are placed upon specialized caseloads upon their return to the community. There's also a statewide transition committee that is staffed by both the State Department of Corrections and county community corrections officials. They meet regularly to identify and resolve barriers for successful reentry.
there has been a renewed push by Director Williams for this committee and to attend to the reentry issues. Obstacles, though, for the committee involve large caseloads and different priorities for institution staff as well as community staff. You also heard today of the Home for Good program, which is a faith-based effort that is a cooperative with the State Department of Corrections that is beginning to establish relationships between prison chaplains and local faith-based community organizations. In Multnomah County, we also have a transitional services unit that is dedicated specifically to early identification of reentry issues and then development of plans that place those offenders in the best position to be successful upon their return. As with all corrections services, these programs require dollars. The governor's proposed budget for community corrections does not fund existing services. We need to begin with a fully funded budget through which we can achieve measurable outcomes, including reduced recidivism of those offenders released from prison. The alternative to full funding would need to be an adjustment to sentencing guidelines that would reduce the number and type of offenders who are placed on probation or sent to prison. Attending to specific transitional needs such as housing, employment, sending community corrections staff directly into the institutions, and placement upon specialized caseloads all require specific dollars. This has been a message that community corrections has been delivering for a number of years. As counties have become more clearly focused on transition, it's become apparent that redirecting existing resources will carry us only so far. To make the cost of prison worth the expenditure, transition has to be considered part of the price tag. Accountability is a term that we are often fond of using in the field of corrections. However, when we're talking about accountability, we're most often referring to the offenders and the inmates. However, there's another important aspect of accountability, and that has to do with the criminal justice system itself. Victims, the public, and those of us in government should demand of ourselves that we require policies and spend dollars in a way that enhances public safety. Public safety that begins not only with arrest, prosecution, and incarceration, but continues through release and successful completion of community supervision. We need to be held accountable to successfully attend to the other end of incarceration. To do otherwise simply makes a prison sentence an expensive timeout. Thank you for the opportunity to come today and to present.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Are there questions from the committee? We've had a little trade-off of the committee members today. Things are starting to get pretty busy around here. So do we have any? Senator Walker?
Madam Chair, I didn't hear anyone today speak to one of the issues that most people don't think about when offenders transition back into the community. Is their insurance costs. So say you've been in prison for 15 years, you haven't had a driver's license, you haven't had car insurance, so you get out of prison, you get a vehicle so that you can get to and from this job that you hopefully get, and you've got to get a driver's license, you've got to get insurance, and the insurance company penalizes you because you haven't had a driver's license for 15 years. There are a lot of things like that in offenders' everyday lives when they reenter society, besides the things that you mentioned, the housing costs.
Yes.
That's a good point, Senator Barker.
And, you know, I didn't throw that as a question, just as another area for people to be concerned about what those costs are. And it usually takes about a year for an insurance company to drop you back down to a decent level because they want to see what your record is.
Okay. Chair Blake and Senator Walker, you're absolutely right. Things as simple as obtaining a driver's license, which for us is probably just more of a minor inconvenience to go to DMV and get that driver's license, is a major obstacle for offenders. As you say, not having had a driver's license, even having proof of residence to go in and get the driver's license, and then, as you say, followed by the cost of insurance, those are major obstacles.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been a very good day. A lot of good information. I want to thank everyone who participated in this today. Thank you very much. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.
Thank you.
Nope, we held it over.